public hanging. This is a hot dog.
My friends, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. It's a beautiful day here in Austin, Texas. Website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives there in MP3 format for you. My email is scott@weekendinterviewshow.com or scott@antiwar.com. I write for them. And in fact, all this weekend, my article about last week's interview with Jim Powell, Blame Wilson, is featured on antiwar.com, so take a look at that. Got a great show lined up for you today. In the second hour, we'll be talking with VZ Lawton, who survived the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, and he's a member of the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee. We'll be talking with VZ all about what really happened in Oklahoma City. And no, Lori Milroy, it was not Saddam Hussein, stupid. Okay, now, first hour should be very interesting interview here with Dean Tong. He's a forensic consultant and expert witness, author of the books Elusive Innocence, Survival Guide for the Falsely Accused, Ashes to Ashes, Families to Dust, False Accusations of Child Abuse, Don't Blame Me, Daddy, False Accusations of Child Sexual Abuse, and Love and Loathing, Protecting Your Mental Health and Legal Rights When Your Partner Has Borderline Personality Disorder. His website is abuseexcuse.com. Welcome to the show, Mr. Tong.
Thanks for having me this afternoon.
It's great to have you on. It's a very interesting subject to me. In a couple of ways, I've known people who have children who have been the victims, basically, of Child Protective Services harassment. And at the same time, I also, close acquaintances of mine anyway, people close to me have adopted a young child who was to be raised by a couple of worthless crackheads. And the state took that little baby away and gave her to someone who can do a much better job of raising that kid. So being a libertarian and an anti-government extremist in all capacities, I'm very conflicted about this topic. So I'm really glad I could have you on to maybe help flesh out some of these arguments. First of all, I'd like to ask you, sir, how exactly did you get into this subject? I sort of get the impression that a personal experience of yours kind of pushed you this direction. Is that correct?
Yeah, I basically was accused by my ex-wife 20 years ago of molesting my 3-year-old daughter, and that's how I got involved. It was a horrific ordeal that cost my family $150,000. We went through 7 different attorneys, 7 psychologists, 6 different courts, and 10 years of litigation. I was arrested, had to clear my name down here in Florida. Couldn't see either of my children, including my son, who I wasn't even accused of abusing for over a year. I found out very quick 20 years ago, and if you asked me then if I thought this was going to be a problem today, that I'd be talking to you, I'd think you're delusional, that you were presumed guilty and you had to prove your innocence. You had to prove you weren't the monster that they were paying you to be, and here's why not. This is the opposite maxim in America. The opposite of our Constitution, of course. But that's what's going on here. This is Uncle Sam at its finest.
There's really nothing worse than to be accused of molesting a child.
Well, and I'm not putting any, I'm not taking away from the fact that abuse is a problem. Certainly, we see 3 million reports of alleged child abuse and neglect in America every year, of which about 1 million are confirmed cases. But that's a very high false positive error rate. 2/3 of these cases are unfounded or false. Now, these are not my statistics. These are the Department of Health and Human Services right from Washington, D.C. So folks can go to my website at abuse-excuse.com, and about halfway down the page, they'll see the link.
Okay, hold it right there. Dean Tong, he's an author and forensic consultant. The website is abuse-excuse.com. We'll be right back on the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back. right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Dean Tong. He's the author of the books Elusive Innocence, A Survival Guide for the Falsely Accused, and Ashes to Ashes, Families to Dust, False Accusations of Child Abuse, and many others. His website is abuse-excuse.com. Now, Mr. Tong, probably, five or six years ago, me and my favorite auntie were walking through the grocery store, and a little girl started crying and saying, "I can't find my mommy, I can't find my mommy." And I began to walk over toward the little girl, and my auntie grabbed my arm, and she said, "Don't you do that. Times have changed. When I was a little girl, if something like that happened, of course, you run up, you grab the little girl, you help her find her mommy, and everything is fine. But these days, you'd be making a terrible, terrible mistake to do that. If you're really concerned about the little girl, what you should do is stand 100 feet away and make sure nobody else kidnaps her until her mommy shows up. But don't you touch her, because you're putting yourself in grave danger."
Yeah, that's correct. We're living in No-Touch Rules America 2005. You can wind up like Michael Jackson in a situation like that. So this is basically what's called in the law in loco parentis, parens patriae. The state is parental babysitters. If you read the book, It Takes a Village by Hillary Clinton.
The state as parental babysitters.
Yeah, basically my point is your kids are not your kids. They're the state's kids, and they are raised by the state. At any time, an anonymous phone call can be made, and the Department of Protective and Regulatory Services, what's now called the Department of Family and Protective Services in Texas, can come in without your say-so and can knock on your door and say, "I want to see your child." Now, they can do that either at the school or at your house, and if you refuse to let them in, by God, they will get a warrant. They will get the authorities to let themselves in. And, of course, if you then resist, they'll take you in for obstruction of justice or whatever they want to conjure up. So they can make a mountain out of a molehill, and they oftentimes do. So we see both sides of the coin. We see the system charged to protect children at risk not doing that to the point where kids die, especially in my state of Florida, to the other side where witch hunts are conducted. And, of course, we've had several examples of those since I went through my ordeal 20 years ago. I'm talking about McMartin, California, to most recently Wenatchee in Washington. And then, of course, you get the other side where you get pedophilia covered up, for example, within the Catholic Church.
Well, and to be fair, obviously, when CPS lets a kid stay in an abusive situation, a kid ends up dying of it, or when perfectly okay parents get their kids taken, that's what gets all the coverage. Clearly, there are times when the CPS does their job right, right?
Absolutely. There are many good social workers out there. There are good sex crime detectives. There are good child protective investigators, unfortunately. However, you do get many that are undertrained and don't have the education to know the difference in child development and child pathology. What is abuse? What isn't abuse? I had a case one time where, and by the way, I've been hired in these cases, and they're from 41 states, by parents and attorneys as a trial consultant. But I had a case where a little girl said that her daddy put his pee-pee on her pee-pee, and, of course, the guy was in jail when I was retained in the case. And what the little girl meant was not that daddy's genitalia touched her genitalia, but that he urinated on top of her urine in the commode she forgot to flush.
Oh, nice.
Now, this is a linguistic error, but this happens more often than not, especially with very young children, the ages 3 to 5. Very suggestible, impressionable kids. We basically are misconstruing what they're trying to tell us.
It's interesting. You know, if you were to listen to Loveline with Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew on the average night, you might get the impression that everybody rapes their kids. I mean, those kids call in. I've listened to that show quite a few times.
We're very sensitized to these issues in America. This is a very socialized institution in this country. My wife is Vietnamese, and certainly they have to worry about putting rice and food on the table over there, more so than the government making sure that the house is clean and that the kids look nice and well clothed and everything else. This is a very, very top issue in this country, and the thing that I have a problem with, of course, is the bottom line money factor. This is not just a child protection agency; it is an industry, it is an establishment. I've always said that if we took the profit away from child protection, the solution would go a long way towards correcting itself.
Well, they have a monopoly, and they have the same problem of all government agencies. The market does not rule what they do. They get paid anyway, whether what they do is right or wrong. They're getting paid with tax money that we don't have a choice but to pay them. And so they suck. But that makes them the same as every other government agency. So how do we set up a CPS system that will get it right?
Well, we first have to go back to the drawing board, Scott. That's going to necessitate a national task force to examine where it was, where it is, and how we fix it to where we should be going. It's the same thing that I basically do when I get involved in a case when I have to work with legal counsel. So there's a section in my book, How to Choose Your Attorney. Not many lawyers know how to successfully try and litigate these cases. Same thing here with CPS. The average caseworker is running probably 30 to 40 cases a month, which is double the average national cap, which is supposed to be between 10 and 15. So they just don't have the time, you know, per person to be able to do the work that they need to do and get it done within 30 days. Basically, every allegation that comes into the toll-free hotline number or 911, which necessitates the presence of Child Protective Services or the authorities, requires an investigation. Somebody has got to go out to make sure that that child is safe and not in imminent danger. And, of course, that requires paperwork. It requires the bureaucracy to basically get going. So I think we need a national task force to examine the statistics, you know, the data that we already have. I think we need professionals like Doug Bezhurov from the American Enterprise Institute, perhaps Richard Wexler.
AEI.
From the National Coalition of Child Protection Reform to look at this on a national scale. And then basically we need to very much look at the repealing and abrogating the Mondale Act, the Child Abuse Protection, Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, CAPTA, from 1974, from 30 years ago, which of course was named after former Vice President Walter Mondale, because this was the cancer that got this wound to be, to basically metastasize like cancer and spread like wildfire.
Well, hang on, let me stop you right there, because I was about to say, when you talk about having a national task force, I was going to say nationalizing this problem was a big part of what made it the crisis that it is today, right? The Mondale Act.
You've got to have national experts to look at the overall big picture.
Well, if you have a national commission, they're going to recommend national solutions.
Well, and you have to do that because CAPTA is a federal law, so the only way to repeal CAPTA is to invoke another federal law.
Okay. Yeah, it's too bad the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions on nullification.
And you're not going to do this on a 50-state level. It's going to be done nationally, and then that national law is going to filter down to all 50 states. That's the way it works in this country.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, so, all right. First of all, how did the Mondale Act precipitate the problem, and why would repealing it be the solution?
Well, because that law basically gave CPS omnipotent power. It gave them the power to investigate. It gave them total immunity. In other words, you couldn't sue them unless they acted in bad faith with premeditation, with malice, which is it's very unusual to get a lawsuit, a successful lawsuit against Child Protective Services. And then, of course, they could take these anonymous phone calls where if you were not a mandated reporter, a doctor, a nurse, a social worker, or a teacher, or a police officer, any layperson could call and remain totally anonymous and ruin your life.
Uh-huh.
So this was the law that basically took place right after former Governor Reagan passed the Equal Rights Amendment in 1969 in California. And, of course, 1974 was also the time when feminism really grew widespread throughout the United States about the same time. Of course, 20 years later, in 1994, former President Clinton passed the Violence Against Women's Act, which was basically the domestic violence version of this Child Abuse Act from 74.
Okay, now, and another thing that it did also was it provided national government subsidies to state and local police agencies who could show that their numbers of child abuse cases were increasing and that kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. That's an excellent point. And very much, again, like I alluded to earlier, this is money engineered and money driven. So certainly if they can falsely inflame the statistics, they're going to get the money.
Right. Well, let's break this down a little bit for somebody who may not quite understand. You run the CPS in Iowa somewhere, and they come to you and say, listen, we'll give you millions and millions of dollars if you can only find us 3 more cases of child abuse in your county. Well, guess what? They go out and they find 3 more cases. One
Absolutely.
Way or another, they're going to find cases.
Absolutely. And I've had cases for something as frivolous and trivial as lice in a child's hair or a dirty house. And I'm talking about allegations now very graphic allegations of alleged anal sodomy or shaken baby syndrome and everything in between. So anything like that they are forced to come out and examine the situation to make sure the child, this is not a family reunification system. This is a child protection system. This is their utmost and foremost goal. Yes, under the Adoption Safe Families Act of 1997, they do have to make reasonable efforts to reunify the family, but make no mistake, their original goal, their only goal really, is to make sure the child is safe and out of harm's way.
And that their own job continues to exist forever.
Absolutely.
All right. We're talking with Dean Tong. His website is abuse-excuse.com, and he's the author of the books Love and Loathing, Don't Blame Me, Daddy, Ashes to Ashes, Families to Dust, and Elusive Innocence. Very interesting stuff. Stay tuned. It's a weekend interview show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. All right, my friends, welcome back. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Dean Tong. His website is abuse-excuse.com. He's a forensic consultant and expert witness in child abuse cases. He's the author of the books Elusive Innocence, Ashes to Ashes, Families to Dust, Don't Blame Me, Daddy, and Love and Loathing. And this is very interesting stuff. To me, I think I said at the beginning, I'm really torn on this topic because on one hand, I don't believe that the state should exist at all, and I don't ever want to be the one providing pressure from below for them to have an excuse to take anyone's money or do anything with it. On the other hand, their basic mandate, if we are to have a nation state at all, their basic mandate is to protect life and liberty, and that means even to protect the child from their parents, obviously. So then the question comes in, when is it okay for the state to come and take away somebody's kids? And I'm really torn because I've had friends who have been hassled because their neighbor decided they wanted to settle a score. Oh, that's the guy that brought back my wheelbarrow all dented up. I'm going to call the CPS on him. And then on the other hand, I am personally attached to a very beautiful young lady who would have been living a life in hell if it not for the CPS who came and delivered her to safety. So, this is one of those things that's really hard for a libertarian to deal with, and basically to help me figure out my own position on this topic is Dean Tong. And Dean, I have an idea, and this may sound insane, but what about this? What if they couldn't take the kids unless they actually arrested the parent? How about a criminal charge to go with taking the kids away?
That's not going to work, Scott, because from a judicial legal standpoint, of course, as I alluded to, I consult in these cases for a living 24/7. They would have to garner 95% evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to attain a conviction. So the way they get out of that is they get you in juvenile court, what's called youth court or dependency court, and only have to prove by preponderance of evidence to take your child, which is 51%, not 95%.
Right.
And they have to terminate your parental rights if you don't comply with their case plan and performance agreement and jump through their hoops. 75% is called or termed clear and convincing evidence to actually terminate your parental rights.
Which, again, is all flawed because there's no such thing as a percentage of quality anyway.
Right. But my point is it's not just CPS that is an error here. Let me premise this by the fact that only 2-7% of all these cases are false witch hunts. In other words, where somebody's out to get Scott Horton and they pick up a telephone and they want to ruin your life. Only about 5% on a national cap average are we talking about false premeditated witch hunts. About two-thirds of these cases, however, are mistakes, errors, what's called in psychology source misattribution errors, where the system got it wrong. I had another case. I told you about the little PP case. I had another case where the African-American family hired me, and their little boy had bruises all over his face. Of course, the CPS and the court gleaned that it was physical child abuse, but what it was Mongolian warts, a genetic defect. So, again, what we don't know that we don't know comes back to bite us on these cases. So that's why we need to further educate and train our people that are out there in the field making basically life-altering decisions among children and families.
Right.
And it's very important that the people out there that are listening to this interview understand that CPS is not just the problem here, but it's also the courts, because ultimately it's the judge who's making the decision whether to keep that child from the family or not.
Right. And I think it is a very good point to bring up, to remind folks that everybody, even government employees, are individuals. And each social worker may or may not be the kind of person that you want being a social worker. I've met personally two different social workers who seem like great ladies to me, although both of them told me when I asked them, hey, tell me this, how many kids do you think are taken from their families who really shouldn't be? And both of these women told me, probably about 10%. 1 out of 10 children taken away, this is in Austin, Texas, 1 out of 10 children taken away from their parents probably shouldn't have been. Now, of course, none of those 1 out of 10 were because of them. It was, of course, all the other social workers back at the office who would make such mistakes. But that means 10 out of 100, 100 out of 1,000 cases, these kids are taken away when it's really not justified at all. That's a pretty high error rate, I would say.
Well, it is. And there are social workers of all different colors and shapes and sizes. That said, there are some that are well-meaning and well-intentioned, but they are misguided. They rule on ideology, kids don't lie, must be believed or protected at all costs, versus empirical data and the science behind this. And that's why most of the reason I win my cases is I use real bona fide experts. In fact, as an attorney, I do some cases with, not too far from you, in Plano for Texas. But, you know, the point is with the social workers and the folks out there listening can go to some of the following websites, NASW.org, which is the National Association of Social Workers, or CWLA.org, Child Welfare League of America. These people, again, they're money-driven, they're contract-driven, they're bureaucracy-driven. And, that's unfortunate because you get so many cases, and again, I allude to earlier, 3 million reports a year for all 50 states. That's a lot of cases. That's a lot of reports. That's a lot of children.
Yeah, and if 10%...
Those 3 million reports might encompass 10 million kids.
Right. Okay, hold it right there. We're about to go out to break. It's the weekend interview show. Everybody think back. Remember that King of the Hill? It's one of the first episodes of King of the Hill where Bobby gets hit in the head with a baseball and Hank almost loses him forever. Be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm Scott Horton, and my guest is Dean Tong. His website is abuseexcuse.com. He's the author of the books Elusive Innocence, Ashes to Ashes, Families to Dust, Don't Blame Me, Daddy, and Love and Loathing. Interesting title there, Love and Loathing, Protecting Your Mental Health and Legal Rights When Your Partner Has Borderline Personality Disorder. What's borderline personality disorder? Is that like the mom on The Sopranos?
Actually, Scott, it's 301.83 in the DSM-4. It's a pervasive personality mental health disorder that is featured by usually women. I'm not trying to be a gender stereotype here, but of the 6 million people that show this disorder, 75% of the same are women. But typically suicidal ideations, histrionic-type behavior, self-mutilation. The way it got its name were people who got involved in borderline relationships. So many of these borderline people, usually women, are on the verge of divorcing. And I think the central thing here with these people is they can't see gray. They only see black or white, what's called splitting, which means when you get involved with these people, you're going to wind up in protracted litigation. You're gonna be going to court until the end. And a lot of these people are required to go on Prozac or Paxil or Zoloft or Wellbutrin, some antidepressant by a psychiatrist. And it is a very severe disorder.
Which reminds me, I didn't get to ask you whether you had a happy ending to your case.
Well, happy in that the state of Florida dropped charges against me, but unhappy in that I never got to see my kids alone overnight until they emancipated and reached the age of 18. Oftentimes in these cases, while CPS gets the ball rolling, the courts err on the side of caution, on the side of abuse, on the side of children. It's in that Las Vegas 50% crapshoot line, and it's a dice toss, and the courts, they're just not sure, so they're not going to make the mistake by putting the child back with a possible predator. And that way, they would rather do a parentectomy, or what I call a fatherectomy, and eviscerate father from the life of the child and vice versa. And they do it quite often. I don't leave it in that area. Obviously, when I get involved in cases, I, again, as I alluded to, take no prisoners. This is a war. We use very, very credentialed experts. But people out there listening need to understand that the system has unlimited resources. When I get involved, you get as much justice as you can afford. Sad but true. This is America. The only way you're really going to beat these people and defeat them at their own game is to spend money and hire real experts.
You know, you talked about earlier how the children are, I guess there's probably nothing in the law that actually says it this way, but at least they're de facto wards of the state. The government basically lets you have your own kids as long as they feel like it. And this brings up the question to me. In fact, the first time I ever heard the term ward of the state, I was told that I was a ward of the state by my government school principal when I was in ninth grade, to which I replied, big F you, I belong to my father, and I ran. But this brings up to me the idea that really the biggest child abusers in America is the government in the first place, in the government schools. There's a story, I don't know if you go to the LouRockwell.com blog, there's a story up there from yesterday about a 5-year-old girl who was handcuffed by the police in her government school. And the guy who entered the blog entry went on to comment that if she does not learn her lesson, that she's going to do what the state says or else, if she does not take her lesson well, she's going to find her brain full of psychotropic drugs. Or they're going to, and this has happened many times that I've heard of, you have to give your kids Paxil or lithium or Prozac or Ritalin, and if you don't, you're going to lose your kid.
Well,
for not putting them on drugs.
You know, make no mistake, the state originally out of the gate does call the shots. Again, if you have deep pockets, if you have that war chest, and you can hire me as the consultant, you can get an expert attorney, a dream team with the right medical and mental health experts involved. You know, it's not going to be CPS's way. It's not going to be the government's way. But these people have a lot of money to spend. This is a huge industry, as I've mentioned. You know, they're going to try to cover their own. It's the fox guy in the hen house. And they can order your kid to be put on drugs against your permission. They can interview your child at school without your permission. They can have medical rape examinations done of your child without your permission. They can conduct structured forensic interviews.
Wait,
not structured at all.
Let me stop you right there on the
mission. They do it all the time.
Let me stop you right there on the examination, the rape examination. If a child has not been raped and yet goes through that examination, that would probably be the most traumatic thing to happen to them in their life up until that point, right?
good point.
And dragged out of class and examined by a stranger?
The scientific data on that was authored by a couple of psychologists out of Texas A&M University, Hickman and Reynolds, in 1994. So, unfortunately, Scott, CPS, and many of the courts and many of the attorneys have never seen this data. They don't understand that a non-abused child treated as a truly molested victim can be victimized just as much as a kid who actually has been raped.
Right. What about homeschoolers? Are they more likely to be targeted by CPS types?
Yeah, they are. Anybody who believes in spanking, homeschooling, doing anything that would be contrary to the mindset of the government or governmental child protective investigator or intake worker is more susceptible and vulnerable to basically their wrath and investigation.
The law does allow for simple spanking on the bottom and that kind of thing, doesn't it?
Well, I'd have to go back and check the Texas statutes on that, but I know I was very instrumental here in Florida in getting what the media touted the spanking bill passed in 1998, whereby you could actually spank your child so long as you did not leave significant welts or bruises on the child. If you did that, you went too far and you could be charged with physical child abuse. But the line between corporal punishment and physical child abuse is not very clear. It's very ambiguous and vague, and for parents who don't know, you better be careful because you could cross that line.
Well, and like you say, you've mentioned a few times about how much money it takes to defend yourself from a case like this. What if you just don't have any money to hire Dean Tong to help be your consultant? You're just screwed? You lose your kid? You never see him again?
I mean, there are some websites out there, cpswatch.com. Vocalinfo.org that can help you. There are organizations out there that are activists that fight together. They go to the media. They go to ombudsman. They go to anybody they can go to get their story heard to try to fight City Hall. This is a very devastating issue financially, emotionally, spiritually, physically, and otherwise, and if you don't have the resources to fight back, or if you expended all of your resources because you picked the wrong attorney out of the gate, you could find yourself in jail or your family broken up very quickly.
What kind of advice do you give people? Somebody calls you and says, man, I don't know what happened, but the ex-wife went crazy and she started making all these accusations. What should I do? What do you tell them?
Well, I have to get a timeline. I have to get a clear, concise picture of where the case was and where it is and what kind of equity at law the person who's calling me is seeking, whether they want custody or they want joint custody or they just want, you know, Disneyland dad visitation time or exactly what are they looking for, or whether they're under a criminal investigation, they're about to be arrested. I get cases like that, too. So every case is different. Every case is individualistic and specific, but people need to get into their computers. I assume most people out there now have computers and they're on the Internet. If you don't, you're living in the dark ages and you need to be. But you need to construct a timeline, which is simply a journal or chronology by dates and events, and jog your memory and type that in. Because every attorney is going to ask for that, and I certainly ask for that when I get a case. And then I do suggest folks pick up my book, Elusive Innocence. It's at my website. It's at Amazon.com. There's a section in there, like I mentioned, how to choose your lawyer. Not all lawyers are created equal. Not all experts are created equal. And in these cases, a lawyer will try to take your money. They'll advertise in your yellow pages or maybe you see them on TV that they handle these cases, but then you find out they do the DUI, the bankruptcy, and everything else, and these cases may comprise maybe 20% of their practice. You need an attorney who does basically this type of litigation only, and those lawyers are few and far between.
What about the question of cooperation? I've heard people say that, you know, really if you're burning your kids with cigarettes, but you tell the CPS lady that, you know, I'm really trying to do better and I really appreciate your help, that they'll probably let you keep your kid as long as you defer to them or seem like you want to defer to them. But then again, if you've never laid a hand on your kid and they come to your house and you tell them, get the hell off my property, you'll probably never see your kid again. So the question is, to what degree should you cooperate or not?
I don't advise people to be that blunt and crass and arrogant with CPS, because unless you have unlimited resources, these people can make your life a living hell in a New York minute, and they will do so. So, you know, take it from me. I've been doing this for 20 years.
Come knocking, you should let them in and try to be polite?
Well, I wouldn't say just let them in. Certainly you want to glean what they're there for. They're not going to, by law, because they have confidentiality statutes, they're not going to tell you who made the allegation. They won't even tell you the substance and content of the allegation. But you can, you know, you can nicely say, look, I'll take your card, and once I contact my attorney, I'll be in touch with you. So then you're putting them on the defense, because when they come up to your door, they're the intimidator, not you. You want to show them in a polite, smart, intelligent way that you can be just as intimidating and, you know, tell them you have a lawyer, even though you don't. But, you know, the point is, you know, if you just sign on the dotted line to a, what's called a consent agreement with your attorney and CPS, you might be consenting to dependency, which means when a judge adjudicates this case, your child is gleaned to be dependent. That, by law, means the child has been abused, neglected, or abandoned, and you could wind up losing your parental rights. So you can't be too crass and arrogant, but you can't be too conciliatory and just agree with everything that they say, because these people can't be trusted. I mean, again, they're well-meaning, well-intentioned, but you can't trust these CPS people. Just because they say they're going to give you your kit back doesn't mean they will.
I've also heard stories about people who began to be investigated because they went and applied for food stamps. And the government says, oh, here, line up here and we'll buy all your groceries for you. Oh, you have kids? We're going to start an investigation because obviously you can't take care of them if you're coming to us for food money.
That is rather hypocritical and oxymoronic, but it happens all the time where the government's caring for you, but then they're investigating you on the other hand. So,
in fact, I read a case on your website.
You know, the poorer you are, the more impoverished you are, the more indigent you are, the more you become a target. So you need to keep a low profile, realizing that anything you say in the court of public opinion can wind back up in the court of CPS.
Right. Right. Yeah, you told a story on your website, on the blog there somewhere, I think, was a story of a woman who had a tiny little Christmas tree and just a few presents under the tree for her kids. And I think you, I don't know if it was you that wrote, I think it was you that wrote the entry that said that, you know, they came and took this lady's kids away because she had so few presents, she obviously wasn't measuring up to society's standards of Christmas time or whatever. But at the same time, I believe you commented, she could have gone ahead and spent, you know, bought a nice tree and more presents and then came to the state and asked the social workers for more money for the bills. But instead, she decided to be frugal, and basically they took her kids away for not getting enough welfare from them.
Yeah, so CPS decided to play Santa Claus and just take the children. Of course, I'm being sarcastic, but, you know, this happens, and it happens more often than you know. And I wish I could, you know, take care of all the families out there in America, but with 300 million people in this country, I just can't. As it is, I field 500 emails a day and probably 5 to 25 phone calls a day from all over the world, and it's rather overwhelming, and I can only win one case at one time until we change these laws. These laws are geared to making allegations. They are geared to inciting allegations. They want allegations to be made. They want reports to be made. The more you see the Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer cases on the front page, the Andrew Yates cases, the more you're going to get more allegations.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? That it's sort of like, I guess I remember, I can't remember the name of the movie now, but when there was some movie back in the 40s or 50s where Cary Grant didn't wear an undershirt, and after that, undershirt sales across the country just plummeted. And people just started wearing their button-up shirts without an undershirt. And it's sort of the same thing with child abuse cases. Like, oh, gee, there's a movie about child abuse. Here, let me find somebody to narc on. I don't know. Give me a phone. Dial 911 and let's see if I can find somebody to point my finger at. TV gave me a great idea.
Well, it does. And certainly there are many Lifetime Movie Network movies after these very issues. On both sides of the coin now, we're starting to see a little more balanced perspective than we were 20 years ago, and starting to see more unfounded and false allegation movies and documentaries and things like that. And I know PBS has done a good job in trying to keep a balanced, objective approach. But unfortunately, the number of cases will always be about 3 million a year. This is a very imperfect system. We certainly need to refine it and hone in on the problems and correct it. And if they started listening to people like myself and allowed us up to Washington, D.C. to show that we have an expertise on this side of the coin, and if you read the right on my homepage, it says, you know, if we win the battle against false accusations, we will win the war against child abuse. And that's very true, because this is as much or more of a problem than actual genuine abuse.
All right, everybody. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Dean Tong. He is a forensic consultant and expert witness in child abuse cases. His website is abuse-excuse.com. His books are Elusive Innocence, Survival Guide for the Falsely Accused, Ashes to Ashes, Families to Dust, False Accusations of Child Abuse, Don't Blame Me, Daddy, False Accusations of Child Sexual Abuse, and Love and Loathing, Protecting Your Mental Health and Legal Rights When Your Partner Has Borderline Personality Disorder. When we get back from this break, sir, I'm going to ask you all about if you all of a sudden were the majority leader of the Senate and it was up to you to rewrite the laws, how would you structure it so that children are protected and innocent families are protected as well? It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton talking with Dean Tong from abuse-excuse.com. He's a forensic consultant and expert witness in child abuse cases. Now, actually, there's one more thing that I wanted to ask you about real quick before how you would have the law written in a more fair manner. But real quickly, I'd like to ask you your opinion on a law that's being debated here in the Texas legislature. Emotions running very high on both sides. The Texas government is attempting to outlaw gay people being foster parents. And right now it's perfectly legal for gay people to be foster parents in the state of Texas, and they're trying to outlaw that. And I want to know whether you have any opinions on that subject, sir.
I'm going to reserve comment on that one, I think, Scott. I'd rather not go there. I get a little too emotional on that one. My state of Florida has banned same-sex custody. Massachusetts, on the other hand, has allowed it. I think the country is divisive on this. I think it's something that's going to be decided, obviously, in Congress, ultimately at the U.S. Supreme Court level.
Right. All right. Well, I respect that. I can see how you don't want to take a stand on an issue like that. I want to say for my own sake that individuals are individuals, and they're all innocent until proven guilty, and the state can go to hell, but, you know, that's just me.
As far as what I'd do if I was in the Senate, I would eradicate both the CAPTA and the VAWA, the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, and the Violence Against Women's Act. I would enact a Children and Families Act nationally, federally, which would include some of the provisions from both of those acts, but number one, it would require mandatory random testing of sexual predators, because recently we've had a rash of deaths down here in my state of Florida, and the science here is being ignored, so we don't know when a sexual predator becomes a violent sexual predator and commits murder, has homicidal ideations and commits murder. So mandatory testing by penile plethysmography and ABLE screening would be very important. We certainly should eradicate the anonymous phone calls that go to these tipster lines and make them confidential to stop the witch hunts. We should abrogate CPS's immunity to give them the same immunity as the police, because right now CPS has more immunity than the officers do, than the authorities do. Police have quasi-prosecutorial or qualified immunity. CPS has sovereign absolute immunity, so we need to, you know, hurl that back. You know, we need to increase the judicial legal threshold in both family and dependency court. It's 51% versus 49%. The credibility, he said, she said, what a child says. We need to up that to 75% clear and convincing evidence. That will cause a lot of these cases to be decided by a greater threshold of evidence, where innocent families will keep their kids versus a judge tilting that pendulum 51 to 49%. So those are some of the things that I would do if I was in, and you know, some of the ideas that I have, you know, to better balance this perspective here with alleged child abuse and domestic violence cases. The other thing, of course, domestic violence against men has become a pretty big issue over the last year or two within the media. The Violence Against Women's Act is exactly what it is. There is no Violence Against Men's Act.
Cool. All right. Well, I sure appreciate your insight today, sir. For people who want to get a hold of you, abuse-excuse.com. Any other websites you want to recommend?
No, that's about it. A good primer book besides mine for people who are more interested in this issue at Amazon.com is called Out of Control by Brenda Scott.
All right. Thank you very much, Dean Tong, everybody. And
thanks for having me, Scott.
You're very welcome, sir. We'll be right back. Talk with VZ Lawton. He survived the Oklahoma City bombing. Stay tuned.